This call is being recorded.
We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren and their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Martin Luther
King, John Henry Clark, John Dr. Jackson,
Muhammad.
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Still labor, started carrying on. It's been a long, 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 You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. As you know, we are here every Tuesday evening from 8 p.m. Eastern to 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central to 9 p.m. Central. And we are so happy to be a part of this network called the Black Talk Radio Network as a part of the Time for an Awakening system. We thank you so much for your participation and your continued participation to this program. Our program here, Black Reality Think Tank, is sponsored by Motherland Media Network and is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. So we thank you, my brothers and sisters, for being here with us this evening. We're going to talk about a very dynamic and invigorating discussion topic. It's something that we want to make sure that we close out this celebration of the great Carter G. Woodson. As you know, here at the Black Reality Think Tank, we don't celebrate Black history. Black history is 365 days a year. But we are giving highlight to the great Carter Woodson, who invigorated this process for us to learn and study about history and have it in our schools and in our workplaces and in our churches and wherever we assemble as a people, that we would appreciate that. So that's one of the reasons this evening I took a little bit more time and played some of those pieces. The great Otis Redding, Change is Going to Come. We know that Sam Cooke originally was the preventer of that, but I wanted to hear the Otis Redding version. And so a lot of our conversation tonight is going to be about that creativity that happens in the African community. It is a very, very powerful system. It invigorates us. Many of our institutions use it to get us moving. The Black Church is well known for using our artistic genius to get us in the mood and to get us producing and moving forward. And that's what we wanted to do here this evening. We want to have a dynamic conversation. We have a lot of you, my brothers and sisters, that are on the line here tonight. We're so happy that you are, and thank you so much. I'm going to be getting to each and every one of you who may desire to say something or talk about this extremely, extremely critical topic. I hope that you all have had a celebratory African Liberation Month in celebration of the great Carter Woodson. Many programs and ideas that have gone forward started off this month, very busy with the Black Reality Think Tank. He did a wonderful lecture at Cardinal Stritch University here in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, for the Christian Women's Perspective. He did a very Saturday event, and then there's an art museum, art gallery here that also produced a program about the blues. So he had a time to come and speak to them as well. And then I was invited to about two or three churches. So it's been a busy time. We hope that this will get home to our children, get into their thinking, into their actions, and we begin to use this 365 days a year. Well, as you know, we're going to get right into our conversation. I've taken up a lot of your time with that little introductory part, but it was necessary, I think, and that we appreciate you. This program, by the way, is all of our programs are archived. You can go to the www.timeforanawakening.com website, which is a part of Time for an Awakening, and you can pick up all of our programs that are aired here. There's some other dynamic discussions that are held throughout the week. We have a program called African Perspectives, which is produced by Brother Oshieme Adelabu. Comes on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then we also have Time for an Awakening, which is Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Their program comes on Fridays and Sundays. Fridays from 7 to 10, Sundays from 8 to 10. And again, dynamic discussions, guests that are really grounded extremely well into the Black nationalist concepts and ideas and the whole Pan-African embracing of history. So we encourage you to listen to them, to listen to all of that right here on the Time for an Awakening Network, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network as well. As you know, and those of you who are frequent to our program here on Tuesday evenings, we always like to do an ancestral profile. We stand on the shoulders of nothing but greatness, and we want to pay honor and tribute to that. We have done that always. Tonight, no exception. We are going to pay tribute to several individuals that are very powerful. A lot of our discussion tonight is going to come out of the Harlem Renaissance. And a lot of the activity of the Harlem Renaissance, as well as some of the other historical factors as well. But tonight I want to pay tribute to a dear and beautiful brother and artist of that period whose name is James Weldon Johnson. And he is no stranger to any of you. Brother Johnson was a diplomat. He was a literary critic. He was a lawyer, an educator. He was a poet. He was an author. And he gave us some wonderful, wonderful, energetic, artistic expression that we can use and have used throughout our life. He was born in 1871, and he transitioned to the ancestral world in 1938. James Weldon Johnson was, along with his literary skills, was an early civil rights activist. He was a leader of the NAACP, and he is considered a leading figure in the creation and development of the Harlem Renaissance. He was born on June 17, 1871, in Jacksonville, Florida. James Weldon Johnson, as I said, was a civil rights activist, a writer, composer, politician, educator, and lawyer, as well as one, as I said, one of the leading figures, the creation and development of the Harlem Renaissance. After graduating from Atlanta University, Johnson worked as a principal in a grammar school. He founded a newspaper called the Daily American, and became the first African-American to pass the Florida bar exam. His published works included The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, published in 1912, God's Trombones, 1927, a powerful book. Johnson transitioned, as I said earlier, June 26, 1938, in Wissahickon, Maine. Well, Johnson was born, in, as I said, in Jacksonville. He was the son of a freeborn Virginian father and a Bahamian mother, and he was raised without a sense of limitations amid a society which was focused on segregating African Americans. After graduating from Atlanta University, he founded the Daily American newspaper, and in 1897, Johnson became the first African American, as I said earlier, to pass the bar exam in Florida. Not long after, in 1900, James and his brothers, John, wrote the song, Lift Every Voice and Sing, which would later become the official anthem of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, better known as the NAACP. The Johnson brothers would go on to write more than 200 songs for the Broadway musical stage. Johnson then moved to New York, and he studied literature at Columbia University, where he met other African-American artists. In 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt appointed James Weldon Johnson to the diplomatic positions in Venezuela and Nicaragua. Upon his return in 1914, Johnson became involved with the NAACP, and by 1920 was serving as the chief executive of the organization. Also during the period, he became known as one of the leading figures in the creation and development of the African-American artistic community, known as the Harlem Renaissance. James Weldon Johnson published hundreds of stories, poems during his lifetime. He also provided works such as I said earlier, God's Trombone, which is a collection that celebrates the African-American experience in the rural South and everywhere. And he then also published the novel, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, 1912, making him the first Black African-American to treat Harlem and Atlanta as subjects in fiction. It was based in part on Johnson's own life. The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man was published anonymously in 1912, but did not attract attention until Johnson refused it under his own name in 1927. After retiring from the NAACP in 1930, James Weldon Johnson devoted the rest of his life to writing. And in 1934, he became the first African-American professor at New York University. Johnson died in a car accident in Wickasset, Maine, on June 26, 1938, at the age of 67. More than 2,000 people attended his funeral, they said. James Weldon Johnson is probably, for me, one of the greatest pieces that he did was his whole God's Trombones. And this has been repeated many times in our community. It's a wonderful expression of poetry. And I just want to real quickly, I'm not going to play the whole piece. I want to play just a clipping of one of his pieces in that powerful book, which is a book of poetry from the Black Church. So let's just hear quickly something, and then we hear it, and then I'll tell you who it is that's recording this.
Weep not. Weep not. She is not dead. She is resting in the bosom of Jesus. Heartbroken husband, weep no more. Grief-stricken son, weep no more. She only just gone on. Day before yesterday morning, God was looking down from his great high heaven, looking down on all his children, and his eye fell on Sister Caroline, tossing on her bed of pain, and God's big heart was touched with pity, with everlasting pity, and God sat back on his throne, and he commanded that tall, bright angel standing at his right hand, be death. And that tall, bright angel cried in a voice like a clap of thunder, call death, call death. And the echo sounded down the streets of heaven till it reached away back to that shadowy place where death waits with his pale white horses. And death heard the summons, and he leaped on his fastest horse, pale as a sheet in the moonlight. Up the golden street, death galloped, and the hooves of his horses struck fire from the goal, but they didn't make no sound. Up death rode to the great white throne and waited for God's command. And God said, go down, death, go down, down in Yamacraw and find Sister Caroline. She's borne the burden in the heat of the day. She's labored long in my vineyard and she's tired, she's weary. Go down, death, and bring her to me. And death didn't say a word, but he loosened the reins on his pale white horse and he clapped the spurs to his bloodless sides, and out and down he rode through heaven's pearly gates, past suns and moons and stars. On death rode, leaving the lightning flash behind, straight down he came. While we were watching round her bed, she turned her eyes and looked away. She saw what we couldn't see. She saw old death. She saw old death coming like a falling star, but death didn't frighten Sister Caroline. He looked to her like a welcome friend. And she whispered to us, I'm going on. And she smiled and closed her eyes. And death took her up like a baby. And she lay in his icy arms, but she didn't feel no chill. And death began to ride again, up beyond the evening star, into the glittering light of glory, onto the great white throne, and there he laid Sister Caroline on the loving breast of Jesus. And Jesus took his own hand and wiped away her tears, and he smoothed the furrows from her face, and the angel sang a little song, and Jesus rocked her in his arms and kept a saying, take your rest, take your ass. Weep not, weep not. She is not dead. She is asleep. She is resting in the bosom of Jesus.
Go Down Death, written by the great James Weldon Johnson in his book, God's Trombones. And the recitation of that piece was by Whitney Phipps. Whitney Phipps, a very deep brother that has been made his presence quite often in the music stage. So anyway, we wanted to just pay tribute to this great brother of the Harlem Renaissance, who also interacted with a lot of those figures. Tonight, we are going to talk about a very important topic. A lot of times, we talk about topics sometimes that seem divisive. They sort of sectionalize parts of our community, which we cannot afford to do. We either do it on gender, we do it on age, we do it on sexual preferences, we do it on color. And it creates a very terrible schism where we need all of our people working together to fight our cause. So tonight I'm not attempting to do that. I am not attempting to create a schism. It is a part of our community that we need to be made aware of from all aspects. It is divisive in itself, but it has its roots very deeply in the history and culture of our people. So to all of you, my brothers, let me assure you that is not what I am trying to do. We're going to talk about the making of the Negrocracy, the making of the Negrocracy. And I've sort of created that word myself years ago in doing some other research work that I was doing. But it simply means when you add that ocracy on the end of it, it simply means that it's kind of like an institution. It has its own rules. It has its own system. And very clearly, as a young man raised in the segregated South, I encountered this group of people many, 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 many times. And the reasons that I did encounter them in that way was all based on the same reason, which is that skin color issue. But anyway, we want to talk about the Negrocracy and looking at why does it exist and what is life, what is its life, its history, its success, if it is any, its failures, and so forth. And we want to move this discussion in that direction. As again, it's not designed to be divisive. That is not what we are doing. We just want to call ourselves attention to it because it does plague us a lot. A lot of it has to do with economics and so forth, but we won't want to discuss that tonight. And so what really got me into this topic is I had just finished reading a book by a brother whose name was Jeffrey Stewart. He wrote a book called The New Negro in the Life of Alleyne Lark. And Alleyne Lark was a brother that was a unique figure, the professor at Howard University during the early turn of the 20th century, very dominant in the Harlem Renaissance. And he struggled with a lot of issues that have brought reason. So this book that was written by Brother Stewart, Jeffrey Stewart, who's a professor, I think Brother Stewart is out of New York University, I believe. But nevertheless, he is a dynamic figure as well, and he's written some very, very stimulating work. He is University of California, Santa Barbara, I'm sorry. He is a professor in Black Studies, University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of a book called Paul Robeson, Artist and Citizen. Paul Robeson, Artist and Citizen. He also wrote a book called 1,000 Things Everyone Should Know About African-American History. And again, his name is Jeffrey Stewart, S-E-T-W-A-R-T, professor of Black Studies. Anyway, he did an 800-page book on the life of Alleyne Lark. And as you read this book, you can see why it's necessary for him to explore it in the way that he did. Lark was a brilliant scholar. He was an intellectualist. He was an artist. He embraced everybody. He did not hide his homosexuality. He dealt with that in a time when America was totally homophobic. And how he handled that, and he embraced a lot of the brothers and sisters of the Harlem Renaissance who also were a part of the gay lifestyle and the gay culture. And I think one of the things that I've said many, many times on this program in terms of the Harlem Renaissance is that there was a lot of energy around that type of behavior. And I'm not going into it yay or nay, but I'm simply saying that it is a factor that if you are discussing the history of this period and the history of the people, it will be necessary to have to bring that to the forefront because they struggled with it. They wrote about it. It was a part of their life. And so, and obviously tonight, that is the same reason that we bring this up as a discussion. So Alain Locke was a good person to launch out from and looking at what this new Negro was and what is that all about and where does it come from. And I think we've got some folks on tonight that are very clearly could discuss that. I was born and raised in the segregated South, as I said, in Durham, North Carolina. Durham was better known, E. Franklin Frazier, the sociologist who wrote a book called The Black Bourgeois. He said that Durham, North Carolina was the capital of the black bourgeois. And we want to discuss why is that and what is the black bourgeois? What did that really mean? And how did it affect those who were not a part of it? And I clearly, in my family, was not a part of the black bourgeois of Durham. They were professional people. They were educators. But they were not a part of it. And as a result of that, I had a chance to see both sides and also experience some of those things. And we've got some others that I know on the line right now who can do the same thing. And they can talk about it. I know there's one brother. I'm kind of hoping that he's on. He hasn't. I see he might have gotten off. Hope he'll come back on. He is definitely a brother that can embrace that. He was owner of a very large bookstore in Carolina. He's been a constant guest on this program. So I hope Dr. Bridges will be able to come back on and share with me and share with and talk about some of that that history. But anyway, we want to talk about how it does affect the African-American community, where it comes from, and how it has implemented itself into our culture to be, in some cases, a very destructive force. Now, it has a long history that we're not going to be able to cover, obviously, all tonight, but I just want to touch on some of the points. And basically, number one, it's rooted in slavery. It is a part of the plantation philosophy, the philosophy of the system of captivity of African people here in the United States, and the rules and regulations of that game, of that system that was developed, as we know, to be called chattel slavery. That's where it starts. It starts there. It's a part of that old logic, divide and conquer. So if there's a division and there are schisms, so forth, then that's where they are. That's where you'll find some of this rooted. Now, like I said, we don't have a lot of time to talk about some of the historical factors, but I do want to mention a few things. As you know, I'm sorry, folks, there's a caller. Your phone is ringing. If you could mute that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Hello. Hello.
Hello. Yes, hello.
Yes.
Okay, someone was there. Yeah, I need you to mute that phone, please, until we are ready to open up the lines for discussion. That was a caller. But anyway, we wanted to, like I said, this is rooted in that system of slavery, and there are discussions that come out of that 250-some-year history here in the British colonies. Now, obviously, slavery is older than that. African captivity system was older than 247 years, but we want to talk about it from that perspective of the British colonists. And one of the things that has always, if we go back and we look at the annals of the plantation owners and those that were in the administrative part of chattel slavery, one of the biggest questions that always plagued that movement is what are we going to do when this system ends? How are we going to handle the folks who are part of it? And that question, that ideology, becomes known as the Negro question. And it's a historical concept that there are books and all kinds of things that are written about the Negro question. And the question basically is, what do we do with the Negro once slavery has ended? This is from the language and the philosophy of the captor. And there are a couple of things that you can look at, and myself as a historian, I've responded that there were two answers, and there may have been more, but in terms of my research, I looked at two answers that were to that question. Number one is that we will handle it scientifically, meaning that we will breed them with the dominant race, we will exterminate them, or we will control their birth control. So those were the three scientific answers that I have concluded were responded. And some of you may have more, which is fine, but these are, for the sake of discussion, these are mine. The other two, the other one had two answers, which was social, that we will be paternalistic and be fatherly-like to this children of a race. This is a race of children. And so we will become fathers, and we'll teach them our way with the possibility of maybe at some time, never assimilation, but possibly a little on the side of integration. And then second would be training. We will train them. We will train them to be like us, and they would create institutions. Well, Dr. Carter Woodson said that all of these systems did nothing but lead to miseducation. And as a result of that, it's what we see today. Our people are still being miseducated in the school systems of America. But that's where this division begins. It begins out of that Negro question. There was a lot of breeding of our Africans. They were definitely, there was so much of that and so pointed of that that there were plantations that were built that were used as breeding farms. And the whole idea was to lighten the bloodline. It's what we call today in military factors, ethnic cleansing. It's to clean the bloodline and to make the bloodline become more European. And that way we'll be able to possibly live with the African once we have changed the bloodline. So they created a classification system. One was mulatto. That was a term that was used. It means the offspring of an African and a European. And then there was a concept called the quadroon, the offspring of a mulatto and a European. So once the African and European made it, the byproduct of that, which was the mulatto, they would then mate with the European to create the quadroon. And then the octoroon, it was the offspring of a quadroon and a European. And by that point, the bloodline was so lightened that you may not even be able to tell whether they were white or black. And then there was in some circles something called a mustife, M-U-S-T-I-F-E-E. It is the offspring of an octoroon and a European. And then there was something called the mustifino. It was the offspring of a mustife and a European. And these were consciously followed during the life of a family. And so after this fifth step, all of the offspring could easily pass for white. And there's tons of literature that suggests that, books by Walter Mosley, Nella Larson wrote a book called Passing, Wallace Sturman, Black of the Berry, and tons of other books. And then it even goes further than that. It goes all the way down to something called a Cascos, and then very clearly something called a Sambo. Now, this was done, a lot of this was done in the Latin American countries and in those islands. But nevertheless, this was an organized system. So the ancestor that we spoke of tonight, James Weldon Johnson, wrote a book called Along the Way. He wrote a book called Along the Way. And this is what he said. He said, in the core of the heart of the American race problem, the sex factor is rooted. He goes on to say that the problem is so deeply rooted that it is not always recognized when it shows at the surface. He said other factors are obvious and are ones we dare to deal with. But regardless of how we deal with them, the race situation will continue to be acute as long as the sex factor persisted. And this was what his response was into what he see. And that is, we can document in history how that happened. So what then happens on the plantation is this mulatto class, this light-skinned group that were all fathered by the plantation owners, began to emerge. They are divided, what Malcolm calls the field hand, the house hand. And he said that these are two systems that would exist along with each other. The problem is with that is that there was privileges to go with that. The European was basically afraid of the purebred African. The purebred African would not accept his captivity, never did, from the day he landed in Africa to the day he landed to the shores of America. He was always equated with the ape, the gorilla, animalistic behavior, and so forth. And he was branded that throughout his life existence on the plantation. So there were two things that take place there. There was the fear that they had of this rebellious possibility. And then there was the privilege that was given to the ones that were born generations there in America that would be light-skinned. And they would be given privileges that blacks would not, the other Africans would not be given. They would be given clothes, better food, live in the house, and some of those kind of things. And so that two pieces of behavior, it's obvious. It's going to create some kind of a schism between each other. But that is where this negrocracy is created. And then the idea, again, to fit into this new plantation assimilationist idea, it would be very, very important that you begin to create the naming process and the other forms of captivity. I've always said that there are three things that are done when a people want to conquer another people for an indefinite amount of time. Number one, you take their tongue. You have them speak English. You make them think where they speak, then the language they speak was bad English. How can I speak bad English if I'm not English? But that is the case. And so as a result, we were forced to speak good English. You were forced to speak the articulation of the European. Second, you take their god, whoever they worship. You make them call that god the name of the European, and you make that god look like them. And then you set up a system to control that, and you give favor to that. That's why the plantation owner was very quick for the Africans that worked for them in captivity as long as to give them a day off so they could celebrate the Jesus, the white Jesus. And they could celebrate it in the way that they did, or even in the case of Islam. The same idea. So these segregationist division pieces, this is the history of it. This is where it's coming from. And then the third thing you do, once you take the tongue, you then breed with the woman, the African woman. You breed her with the European male. And you have her to then have that child to be recognized of who his father is, and therefore there may be some reluctancy to rebel if you have to rebel against your father. And so this system goes into place in the plantation very early. It didn't begin in the 19th century. It began in the 18th century. This behavior would find. And there is literature very clearly that supports all of this. And again, this is Carter Woodson's beginning of the whole miseducation of the Negro that he wrote in the 1930s. The labeling, the distraction of family life becomes very horrible. And one of the biggest things, again, was that the continued association that the African was a gorilla. To the point that even those Europeans, I mean, those Africans that would mate with their plantation owners and produce the mulatto children, would also begin to take on that behavior that, yeah, they are gorillas. I'm not going to bother with them. I'm not going to mess with them. And they're ugly. I don't want to date them. You can't date my daughter. And so we began to get some of that behavior. We know about how all of that works. There were towns in North Carolina, for instance, that were designed only for light-skinned people. North Carolina was big tobacco country. And all those local farms grew tobacco for the big tobacco manufacturers. And so they created towns for their mulatto children. There were a lot of them around the North Carolina, Ahoskie, Warrenton, all very light-skinned people. And they had rules and regulations that they played. You could not go into those towns if you were dark-skinned. You definitely could not date their women, those light-skinned girls. And I recall that even going into the 60s when I left high school and went to places like the A&T College in Greensboro out of there. You could not date a light-skinned girl if she was from a Husky or Warrington. She wouldn't date you. She said she could not have you take you home to her mother to be as dark as I am. And then we all know about the New Orleans situation and the Creole development culture and the octoroon balls that they had in New Orleans where the light octoroon women would take their daughters and rich Frenchmen would come and would get the permission of the mother, pay the mother, and then be able to have her daughter as a concubine. And they would ride around New Orleans in coaches. This is a division process because now the grassroots darker-skinned people see this and you got this real deep schism. And then couple that with education as they began to develop the traditional African-American schools. And we go back and we look at that. Even as you look at places like Tuskegee, Booker T. Washington was very clearly half white, half black. His father was a white man, but he didn't let that dominate him. But he did use it, and as a result of that, Andrew Carnegie, Jay Gould, and some of those very wealthy industrialists would embrace him, knowing that he had the possibility to be different, and so that also created a schism. And then look at Howard University, which is where Alain Locke was spent most of his time. Howard was basically created out of that whole idea. If I'm not mistaken, in the very early years, Howard was founded by this man, and I heard Dr. Bridges talk about him, who was trying to build a school for his daughter, his white daughter to go to, and it didn't work out well. And so as a result of that, blacks began to go there, but it was a real high mulatto class of blacks. And that carried on right into the 60s. Those of you who are in the background, your mic's alive, so we can hear you. Could you please mute that, if you don't mind? Could you please mute your mic? Please mute your mic in the background, please? Thank you. And then we'll be finished in just a minute, and we're going to open up the switchboard to for those of you in the audience. But right now, if you could mute your mics, I'd greatly appreciate that. So anyway, Howard University was created out of something like that. And then some of the other black colleges would also see the same. Universities like Xavier, Southern, were created for the mulatto. A University of South Carolina State, by the Strom Thurmond family for his mulatto children, his mulatto children of his concubines, that we now know the history of. And so that then, and that education becomes totally different. They don't learn anything about their culture. And so this is what Carter Woodson ended up responding to, even though he was a mulatto in certain ways, but Bernella said he did not practice that. Carter Woodson, in the book, The Miseducation of the Negro, written in 1931, he said that the Negro thus educated is a hopeless liability of the race. Hopeless liability of the race. When a Negro has finished his education in our schools, then he has been equipped to begin the life of an Americanized or Europeanized white man. But before he steps from the threshold of his alma mater, he is told by his teachers that he must go back to his own people from whom he has been estranged by a vision of ideas which in his disillusionment he will realize that he cannot attain. Even if Negroes do successfully imitate the whites, nothing new has thereby been accomplished. You simply have a larger number of persons doing what others have been doing. The unusual gifts of the race have not thereby been developed, and an unwilling world, therefore, continues to wonder what the Negro is good for. Carter Woodson, Miseducation of the Negro. And I think that is the summation of what the Negrocracy is about. It was a buffer zone between the Euro power structure and the rest of black folk. The Negrocracy was used to screen us out. If you wanted something, you go to the Negrocracy first. They would pass it on to their white masters to determine if you should be served. and that still operates to this day. A lot of the politicians that we see in office operate out of that paradigm. There's a buffer between them and white power. So if you want to access that leadership power that you need for resources, you must go first before the necrocracy. And I would challenge anyone to tell me that that's not what happens. Barack Obama, good brother, necrocracy, he was the buffer zone. But not that he necessarily totally embraced even helping African Americans in that way. But very clearly, he was a figure that could be used to do some things that were necessary to do at this particular time in our culture. And so Woodson, in his book, concluded, he said that the Negro, so far as he is able, should develop and carry out a program of his own. He must carry out his own program. And then Marcus Garvey, responding to all of that colorization that was going on in the black community, he said that the black skin is not a badge of shame, but rather a glorious symbol of national greatness. And that is the reason why the African-centered idea is challenged so often from the academic community, because of the fact that it's attempting to show that there are men and women of greatness who may not necessarily be of a light complexion or mixed with the blood of the European, but at the same time can do great and wondrous things and have done them so in history. We did a program not too long ago with Paul Robeson, and very clearly one of the issues with Robeson was his dark skinness. And there was an attempt to sometimes screen him out of his own community because of that darkness. And that there are others have been the same way. Tuskegee Institute, for instance, one of the presidents that came in the 1970 said that when he applied for the position as chancellor of Tuskegee, the black folk of Tuskegee did not want him because he was too dark. He said even though he had a light-skinned wife, he was too dark for that. And he had a degree from Harvard and Yale. But yet they still did not want him because he was too dark. And there have been other chancellors of these black universities that would not be able to get the position had it not been for some other areas because they were too dark. North Carolina Central University, Julius Morgan, I think it was last name right now. But anyway, he was challenged about his darkness in terms of becoming the chancellor of a university like that. And so a lot of them for a long time. Spelman has had nothing but light-skinned chancellors in most of his history. Howard, the same thing. Dr. Mordecai Johnson was a very light-skinned mulatto man, you know, and that is the only way that he would have gotten support and help. So that is, in a nutshell, the division about the necrocracy and why we have to begin to move toward changing that, and how do we change it? And if, like Woodson said, if you do change it, what is it going to do? You know, is it going to create anything possible? Because like another quote that Woodson had, he said, if the Negro in the ghetto must eternally be fed by the hand that pushes him into the ghetto, he will never become strong enough to get out of the ghetto. And so very clearly, I think it has a lot to do with our own economic questions and the way we move. So if the Negro, as Carter Woodson says, does successfully imitate the whites, if they have their cotillions and their special ballrooms and they wear their suits and clothes like Brooks Brothers and some of these other high fashion European items, then what good is it going to do? You're still not going to be able to carry forth some of the agendas that need to be done for independence. And that's one of the good things with the book on Alain Locke. You get a chance to even delve into the life of a man who wanted to do that. He wanted to live the life of a European black man. He tried with everything he could, even with his homosexuality plaguing him. And the community knew about it. I mean, it wasn't like he was hiding it. He didn't operate out of the closet. he openly embraced it. He openly embraced it with the other Harlem Renaissance writers and poets who were also moving toward that direction, moving in the direction. But he wanted to do that. He tried very hardly. And eventually it killed him, and he was not able to do that in any way. He wrote the book. He actually wrote the book called The New Negro. Now, in some cases, it's not just necessarily saying that you want to be a European white man by calling it The New Negro. But he's saying that he did say some good things. He said, you must embrace the Africanness in you. You know, now, Alain Locke did say that. And he even attempted to travel to Africa to be able to get better understanding of life in Liberia and other places. And he went to some folk to get help to try to do that. He was a Rhodes Scholar, but his money ran out. He couldn't use it that scholarship money to go to Africa. So he tried to go to the AME church, and he couldn't do it either. Lane Locke was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He was born among a very aristocratic black family. His great-great-grandfather was a wealthy man in the Philadelphia area. His grandmother was an artistic, educated woman. She was from the Bahamas. And he traveled with the Hobnobs of Philadelphia. And I've said this over and over again. Philadelphia has got some serious history. And a part of that Negroocracy comes out of Philadelphia, even more so than Harlem. Harlem has an aristocratic community, but not like Philadelphia, North Carolina, Atlanta, those places. Even in the early years of Atlanta, there was a Negroocracy there. But I think one of the biggest ones was Durham, Tulsa, Oklahoma. A lot of the Tulsa race riots has a lot to do with that class thing and that class division. And those of you who may get into it, you will know that. But anyway, this is the footing that I want our panel to discuss in relationship to that. And as I said, this was Alain Locke was used as a launching pad for me to get into this discussion because very clearly, you know, it was something you just had to embrace. So I want to go over here. Let's see if my brother, possibly Brother Bridges, he's not here, he's off, so I'll go to somewhere else. But I want to start off talking about what maybe is your experience of dealing with the Negro middle class. This may have been him coming back. Dr. Bridges, is that you, 7789?
Critical Access Hospital.
Dr. Bridges? No, not him. Okay. Let me go to my brother, Herbie White. Brother White is from Durham as well. Brother White, is that Negroocracy dead in Durham now? Is that elite group that led Durham, led the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, responsible for helping Dr. James E. Shepherd with North Carolina Central University and some of that? Is that eliteness still there, or is it gone? Brother White? Brother Herbie White?
Yeah, good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Oh, good evening, my brother. Yes. So what do you think? Mm-hmm. Is it still there or is it gone?
It's hard to say because I'm not originally from Durham. My family is from Durham, but I lived in New York.
Okay, okay.
Until I was like 65 years old, 62 years old and whatnot. So I lived in Brooklyn up until that time.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And basically, where I lived in Brooklyn, it was the ghetto. I lived on Fulton Street.
Yeah, New York didn't have that. New York has some of it, but it was up there in that up there toward that Martha's Vineyard stuff, up in that realm. But Bird Rally didn't have it in the city. You're correct about that. Harlem did have some in Harlem, particularly during the Renaissance. But it lately went out of the way. It lately washed away by the time like I got to New York. I got to New York in '63. Some of all that Negroocracy had gone. There was money, but it wasn't money from that. You know, you're right. What do you think is the danger of that, Brother White? Is there a danger in terms of our community today in this division process and the Negroocracy operation?
The greatest danger is that it negates the opportunity for rebellion.
Okay. Okay.
Because you have that division where one person can't trust another person.
Right.
You know, so there can't be that unity because you got this group over here that thinks that they're better than that group over there, and these people, and therefore you don't trust one another. And where there's no trust, there's no unity.
Right. And that was by design. I mean, that was the that was plantation politics. That's the way the plantation had to operate. It operated over through division, and it didn't stop when chattel slavery ended. It didn't stop. It just kept going until now. It's really, really bad.
And even in New York, it was a division when I was young, like say in the 50s, everybody was basically poor. But when black people started to make the breakthroughs and get civil service jobs,
right,
and get city jobs, people started thinking that they was better than the other people because they had a little bit better job, and they had and basically they wouldn't share the information with other people because they wanted to be the, you know, the HNIC.
That's exactly right. You know what? I did some reading on A. Philip Randolph's The Brotherhood of the Sleeping Porters concept. And at one time, that job was considered to be of the aristocratic nature within the black community. The
Brotherhood.
Yeah. And as a result of that, if you had a job on the train, the sleeping car porters, you was the man, you know, and everybody looked up to you. In a certain way, and so it itself created a division process as well. You know, you're right, and there were jobs like that, but again, you're working for whites, and you're being controlled by them. That's the difference in terms of, like you said, that division process. You know, you got to be approved by white power in order to be recognized in your own community.
And then once you had that job a little bit, paid a little bit more, then you started buying brand name clothes.
Right. Right. And new cars and stuff like that.
And your and you substituted materialism for self esteem.
Right.
So, you know, I wear this and I got full gaiter shoes and I do this and that, and then you look down on people who had less than that.
Exactly. And, you know, that's a lot of, we did a program back here about a month ago about the game of pimping and deconstructing the whole pimp idea. Well, in a lot of cases, that's what they were doing. They were trying to create a society where they could be looked at as worth something, you know. So they drove big old fancy cars and they outdressed everybody on the street. And, you know, it was creating a world that they felt like they were somebody. Everybody wanted to be somebody, you know.
Ostentatious behavior.
Yeah, exactly.
And the clothing and the kind of cars that you drove, that set you apart from other people.
That's right, exactly right. And I think, you know, when we look at a lot of our institutions, it's kind of were created in that way. The black church. I've often argued that the black church was a way of creating somebodies out of nobodies. You know, on Monday through Saturday, old Brother Jim wasn't. He was a farm boy. He was a boy on the working for Mr. Charlie, and he was a nobody. But on Sunday morning, he became Deacon Jim. He had a briefcase and he had on his new suit, and he walked into church with pride because I'm Deacon Jim, because on Monday through Saturday, he ain't nothing but a boy and a nobody. And so the black church gave black folks some substance that they could chew on. Black preachers came out of that tradition. All of them in the beginning, right? They weren't trained in these seminars. They learned how to preach out there in them plantations. So they became somebody. Thank you, Brother White. Very good. Let me go over here to. Brother Timothy, I keep getting this feedback about Philadelphia, man, and you were raised in Philadelphia. I think you said you were born and raised there. Tell us a little bit about what you know and relate to that aristocracy, the black aristocracy of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I know a little bit about it. Just a minute, sir. I remember when Du Bois did the Philadelphia Negro, you know, he covered a lot of that aristocracy there. So why don't you share that a little bit? What do you know about that negrocracy of Philadelphia?
Well, brother, when you speak of the bureaucracy of Philadelphia, the first place you got to hit is Lincoln University, because all those Negroes who educated themselves, it's nice that from my house I can get to Lincoln in an hour. So it was convenient for them to go there, to be at the, you know, in the beginnings of Lincoln University. See, Lincoln University in Oxford, Pennsylvania, the Lincoln University, not the one in Missouri, the first black HBCU to give a four-year accredited degree, was that was once called Hensonville.
What's called
they
what?
Were farmers there. Hensonville.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right, Hensonville.
Okay.
And there were two men, and they were from Liberia. And they came from Liberia, and they wound up, which is now called Oxford, which was once called Hensonville, as farmers. And they wanted to get a degree in the ministry.
Okay.
So they went to a guy who was a Presbyterian at a church, and he said, look, I can't do that for you, he said, but maybe we'll try a way to work it out where we could start in divinity. And that place that he was talking about, that the Amos brothers, the first founders, with John, don't nobody tell you no different, two Africans from Liberia University,
mm-hmm.
It started out as Ashman Institute.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And listen to me. Now, once, and we're also Princeton, some of the Princeton professors, and that's why our ascot is a lion. Princeton's is a tiger.
Right.
So with the assistance of some of the Princeton professors, they didn't help Lincoln people for so far. What they did was it became Ashman Institute. Now, General Otis Oliver, who's the general who started Howard University, he got the idea from Lincoln. He sat in on the first 10 graduating classes at Lincoln University. And he said, I want to do what's going on at Lincoln. He was on the board. And so when he in D.C., yes, he wanted to do that for his daughter. That's why Howard started off as an integrated school. Howard didn't start off as being black. Exactly right. There were white folks there. But let me move on. I'm going to move on and say that where the aristocracy came from, the Negro aristocracy, is starting with Paul Robeson's father.
Okay.
Paul Robeson's father, who was a black Quaker. And people disagreed with that marriage because he escaped from slavery from North Carolina, fought the Civil War. See, a lot of people who were buried in Lincoln's ground,
uh-huh.
Fought in the Massachusetts 54. They're called Hensonville Heroes. They fought in the Civil War, and a lot of them graduated from Lincoln. He was one of them. And from there, so his sister-in-law, his wife's sister, her name is Gertrude. Right. Now, from that, you have the Moselles. You ever heard of a painter called Tanner, Henry Tanner?
Yeah, Henry Tanner, yeah. Yep.
Henry Tanner, the Robesons, the Moselles, right? The Grimkes, all those people graduated from Lincoln, and they were all a part of the talented town.
What was the name of that community that Du Bois wrote about in the Philadelphia Negro?
The Philadelphia Negro. That was the 7th Ward. I could walk to my house from the 7th Ward.
7th Ward, okay. Is it still that way today?
7th Ward. Yeah, now listen to me. Richard Allen's church is in the 7th Ward.
Okay.
William Still.
Okay.
The father was from the 7th Ward, and so was his son. Went to Lincoln and got his law degree later on.
Right.
So when you talk about Philadelphia, all those talented people couldn't go to a place else but Lincoln.
So you're saying that the Quaker experience was the pulling, was the drawing card for a lot of those the Philadelphia aristocracy among African people. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
I would say that, but remember this, though, and one reason why I only gave a four-year degree in divinity, it started a medical school in 1870. It went from 1870 to 1873. Guess what happened, Dr. Rogers?
What's that?
They said that wasn't in our charter. We want divinity. If you look back, the Kumba and Ezekiel only had degrees in divinity.
Right.
See, later on, you know, they said, well, it was too late to start the medical school. If we would have started our medical school, if it would have continued, it would have been in Westchester.
Right.
So now, what happened is the idea of what happened with Howard, with the free, see, with Howard was the Freedmen's Bureau. Look over there at the NDC. Right. So they were able to start their medical school, their law school, their PhD program. And let's be for real from what I heard about the history of Howard. Starting with Lincoln, also Cheney, you have to say that it was a model for Howard to have a PhD program, a divinity program, a law school, a medical right. school,
yep.
and athletics. Listen, I've read books where people would marvel, especially white folks, to see, look what these people were doing with education.
Right. That's what James Locke, that was what Alain Locke was doing when he wrote the book, The New Negro. He was creating that right. image. And he was trying right. to say, and in some ways he was attempting to be helpful and to say right. Africans could attain some level of achievement because what was coming out of the plantation South is that we were ignorant, stupid, dumb, and we couldn't learn or do anything. We never had done anything. So these were attempts to try to correct that, you know. And so you're right. Philadelphia is really, really interesting place.
But here's the other thing, Doc. Never forget the history of Yaqub, like the messenger taught us.
Right.
In the history of Yaqub, the white man's theory, and physically it happens, was to destroy the darker and marry the lighter onto the lighter. Destroy the dark and marry the lighter onto the lighter. He said, with overtaking their mind, you can control their bodies. Right. And he does it right now today.
Yep.
Give you an example.
Yep.
I'm in a fraternal order. Now I'm a Kappa. We got all kinds of colors. People have different tuxes, hair. We're tall, we're short, we're everything else. But in the minds of a lot of fraternity people, Qs and Alphas, that paper bag theory, which I never experienced, is still in their minds psychology. With the Deltas, the AKs,
It sure is.
It's there. I'm going to tell you, it's there.
Yeah. Let me ask the Brother Pugh. I want to ask him. Brother Pugh, you have your engineering thinking and your ability to look at a system of things. Brother Timothy just said something very critical. It seems that a lot of the necrocracy development was ushered in by fraternities and sororities, and I'm not attempting to attack anybody's who may hold dear to any of those things, the Masonic Lodge, the Shriners, the Odd Fellows, and all of these social organizations were in some ways the creator of the of this necrocracy mindset. Because I know that a lot of sororities and I assume fraternities too, if you were not of a certain complexion, you would not be allowed to join that particular sorority or fraternity in that particular area. I think it went by area more than it did by standard. I know, for instance, it was well known that the Deltas in Carolinas would be all light-skinned women, and the AKAs could be dark-skinned women. But then in other areas, it went to the opposite direction. So the question I asked Brother Pugh, what is it that you think these institutions allow that kind of development? You know, what is the energy behind a lot of that?
What is the energy behind
The fact that all of this necrocracy behavior and attitude came out of the sororities, fraternities, and lodges? What generated that, you think? What makes that kind of structure possible to create that kind of a division?
Well, if you're saying, if I have if you set the standards for me, then I want to assimilate to your standards.
Okay.
And it was, I'm not quite sure.
Okay, I know it's kind of a complicated question itself. But what I'm trying to figure out and see what we can understand. What makes, because, a lot of times these are fraternal orders and these are groups to get people together to build independent institutions. But what makes, and I'm going to just use this as an example, and I'm clearly not saying that this is the case, but what would make the Alpha Phi Alpha say that we only want light-skinned men and the Deltas say we only want light-skinned women. What is it driving there? Is that based on the fact that there'll be economic opportunities that they can get that nobody else won't be able to get? Is that what it is? How is it that these vehicles are being used to sort of push forward this whole division thing that we see and that we're talking about tonight?
Right. Well, that is certainly has been the case.
Yes.
In other words, when you've got limited opportunities and whites express a preference for certain kind of people, then you want to sort of husband, the opportunities. And, you don't want people to let people in your organization who might harm your good thing. And so so I can imagine that, you set up some boundaries as to who can get in and so on.
Because, you think about I don't know how much you know about organizations that they had called the Boule, and some of those things that were started out of those different sororities and fraternities. And I know for a fact that it has trickled right down into the 2000s, into the 21st century, that there are, for instance, are employers or where blacks have high positions. They are VPs and they are in charge of HR. They will only bring in their fraternal brothers and hire and give them those well-paying corporate jobs I'm just wondering if we talk about dismantling that, how is that done?
Well, I'm going to say something controversial.
Okay.
That's the impression I had about Kobe Bryant.
Okay.
The whole ideal of, this Pelinka being his best friend and him just being an athlete, not necessarily, a superstar. In other words, the idea that a white person could be equivalent, it could be equal to him, but no black other than, say, a Michael Jordan, to be equal, strikes me as some of that kind of thinking.
Right.
The fact that he, had, at least I didn't see it, no connection whatsoever with his family, no acknowledgement of his mother, his father, and his sources,
right,
but all kind of acknowledgement of white people, that suggests the kind of internalization of the kind of norm that basically says that the things that are of value are white things and the things that are not of value are non-white things. So I think that's...
And that's a good that's a good connection
going on today.
That's a good connection because you're right. With Gail, what's her name? The one that did
right. I was talking with a friend and he was talking about Minister Farrakhan had mentioned that.
Yep, sure.
And
did.
I was saying that Gail, her and Kobe were really on the same page.
Okay,
In other words, he was Minister Farrakhan. He said that he suggested to black people who had access to white power, or I forget the word he used, but in other words, black people that had access, he said, don't allow your access to be used against your people. And actually, I don't think Gail was attempting to use it against her people. Now, what Kobe was doing was against black people, but what Gail, I think, was doing was that black people, in order for us to move the ball in this society, we're going to have to win the presidency and the Senate. In order to win the Senate, we need white women. And one of the things that Gail wanted to do was to throw Kobe under the bus to tell white women that I'm your sister, I'm with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's in the name of black power. That's right. That's the point of what she was doing. And of course, she was called out, by Snoop and whatnot.
Good point.
But in the case of Kobe, the whole ideal of Mamba mentality and all of that, these are fundamentally anti-life ideas.
Yes.
Fundamentally, and in fact, this whole the things that we saw, the evidences of excellence and whatnot. you know, on the one hand, this society celebrates that because this is a criminal society. Yes. Oh, and by the way, let me just say one other little tight thing.
Okay.
You know, when you've got these kind of religions which claim that, in fact, when you quoted James Weldon Johnson in that poem,
right,
where, you know, he's talking about laying in the bosom of Jesus when you die.
Right.
Well,
right.
Your ancestors didn't think that nonsense.
No.
Your ancestors, they understood. In fact, the historian Joyce Ladner, the other day I saw something on Facebook where she was making the point, you know, they were trying to convince the Republican senators that, you know, they should be concerned about, you know, how history is going to look at them. And therefore, you know, they should vote, you know, to have witnesses and see the evidence in the Trump impeachment trial. And Dr. Ladner said that, well, you know, I'm really not concerned about how people see me. I'm concerned about the legacy I leave.
Right.
Well, that's the way your ancestors thought. In other words, you don't have to tell me no nonsense about living and, you know, going to heaven and being with God and all that kind of stuff when I know for a fact that I left my community intact.
Right.
I know for a fact that I left some healthy children with healthy relationships in a healthy environment. In other words, I know I've done my job because I see my job.
Right.
It's manifest, as opposed to the notion that somehow or another I die, and if I did it right, I can, you know, get on, you know, that's just absolute
and you're so right, because James Weldon Johnson, as brilliant as he was, I love his work, he was a part of that necrocracy. Maybe it's just out of time and circumstance and environment. But very clearly being in the NAACP and embracing some of the ideas that they had, and the fact that the president was willing to make him an ambassador to Venezuela, said that he was thinking in the European mindset. And so very clearly.
Well, it's not just because, see, the debate that's going on right now in this society, you've got a plutocrat Bloomberg, you've got a socialist Sanders, you have a Democrat Warren, and then you have a Nazi Trump. These are different visions of what you should do in the world.
Yeah.
And one of the and you know the book by Max Weber. What was it called? Capitalism and the Protestant ethics and the some. In other words, this whole notion that the things that you attain are a measure of your worthiness to be on this planet.
Right.
Well, that's the spirit that animates, you know, the Negroocracy. That's the spirit that's what the debate is in our society right now among white people.
Exactly.
As to
exactly.
Whether or not who can produce the most, you know, growth, and whether or not, you know, our goal should be getting to Mars, or, you know, deciphering the genome or whatever. So, I mean, all of these things are related to this move from the ancestral idea that the purpose of life is life to some other, I would argue, the Egyptian idea that the purpose of life is death.
I got you. Thank
which
you.
They call.
I want to go over here to a number from New York City, 917-662. I don't know if you want to say something or you're just listening. 917-662, you want to make a comment or are you just listening?
I'm just listening.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much. Sister Yan, what do you think? Necrocracy. Why do we have to have debutante balls with women in white dresses look like they out of France or European? What was that all about? What do you think? What's the mindset here going on? What's going on?
Well, you know, first, greetings to everyone, and peace and love. And the conversation so far has been really good. You know, I've just been absorbing what's been said by everybody. Everything that was said has just been great. In terms of, you know, awareness and being informative. So this is what I think.
Okay.
It's a shame that we were turned into such self-hating human beings that we accepted the teachings, and we had no choice with the slave mind, that the only way that we could be somebody is to emulate or mimic white Eurocentric culture.
Okay.
That's a shame because it is a very destructive culture, very divisive. I think one of the brothers said it earlier, very divisive culture. And personally, I hadn't encountered a lot of that. I saw some of just a little bit of it. But I also grew up in the hood, like Brother Herbie White was saying, in Brooklyn. So, you know, we were doing our thing. So we knew very little bit about that. But as I learned, about this whole Negrocracy and aristocratic attitude, it separated us in ways that we don't need.
Right.
And especially, you know, the light-skinned, dark-skinned thing, because I see, you know, some of the billionaires that exist currently in the black community are mulatto, very white-looking. I was listening to George Frazier, you know, and for a minute I couldn't tell whether he was black or white.
Okay.
And the same thing with another billionaire. I think his name is Roberts, you know, and these guys are paraded around. Another sister that's, you know, part of so-called 1%, very light-skinned.
Right.
You know, and they're paraded around as this is what you need to be. And that's not something we need to be telling our children to aspire to.
Right.
It's destructive to the race. And I have a problem with those in that group. I wouldn't call them a class. In that group that want to be as white as possible, that they're causing problems. They're causing problems in our community. And I always talk about this now, you know, promoting millionaireism. That's not a reality for the average brother.
Right.
And so when you promote all this, you know, be as light as you can, the more white blood we get into us, the worse we become.
Right.
The more individualistic, the more capitalistic and greedy and all of those Eurocentric traits.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot. I kind of lost my thought. But, you know, just to focus a little bit on, or say something rather about capitalism, I'm watching as conscious black people are promoting capitalism.
That's right.
And
they have for a long time. They've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah. And you would think with consciousness, you know, especially level of consciousness that we have now, that we would understand we have to do the opposite, you know, Ujamaa, cooperative economics. But conscious people promoting this thing and promoting greed and, like I said, millionaireism, and then our young people going to jail.
Exactly.
Trying to reach.
You know, one of our Dr. Manny Marable, wrote a book called How Capitalism Undeveloped Black America. And then you had Earl O'Farrell Hutchinson's book, The Myth of Black Capitalism. So they've been spelling out just what you're saying, Sister Young, in showing how that has been very destructive. And that is clearly tied into this negrocracy, light skin, dark skin stuff, is the money, you know, the economics. And so as a result of that, it's very detrimental, very, very, very detrimental. I want to go over
you know,
here.
The other thing, Doc, are you still, am I still on mic?
You're still on,
You know, from a psychological perspective or the perspective of the damage to the black psyche, mulattoes, and I hate to use these, you know, label us. I want to just see us as a black African people, but those are the called mulattoes. Those are some very confused people.
Right.
They don't, because oftentimes whites don't fully accept them. Even now, whites don't fully accept them, and blacks, you know, feel a way about them.
Okay.
So, for the most part, they're not fully accepted by either race.
No, they're
of
not.
People,
definitely
either
not.
Group of people. And so they suffer a confusion.
Yes.
There was a young lady that was brought to one of our sister circles a couple of weeks ago. Her mother was white, and the suffering, you know, I've heard this a lot over the years, not knowing where you belong.
Right, right.
And then add a lot of money to that. It literally alienates people.
Exactly.
But this young lady was a cutter. Mm-hmm. You know, cutter being someone who cuts themselves with razors and, you know, and just they're physically self-destructive.
Right. You know, I've heard Nia Long, the actress, who's the dark-skinned sister, talk about the whole thing with her and Halle Berry and Jada Pickett and how they get roles that, you know, she can't get because of the fact of their light-skinned, dark-skinned thing. And then, as you said, Halle Berry gets it, but then look what she has to do, like she did with Monster Ball. And the image she had to do there. And Dr. Dandridge ran into that same thing in her whole Hollywood career.
What did she do? She committed suicide.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's why they call them, there's a term in history called the tragic mulatto. And I said, we're not attacking any of that system, but it comes out of plantation politics. That's the bottom line. It's a plantation concept. And it's carried over into the modern world. Let me go over here to 919-956. Are you listening, caller, or you have a comment?
What's up, my brother?
Oh, there you are. I thought you were on before. I thought I recognized you. How you doing, good brother?
I'm all right. What about you?
All right. You come from the capital of the bourgeois. What has your experience been, Dr. Bridges?
I just tuned in. I was doing two or three things. I was on earlier, and then I just heard sister Nisawa, and I heard Brother Pugh coming in, and it's really something that, as you say, it came down from the plantation. It really came down from the plantation when we came to America. As you talked about, I heard you mention chattel slavery earlier, and you find that the closer anything was, whether it was your dress, your walk, your talk, the suit you were wearing, your thinking, or whatever it may have been, your hair, your skin color, the closer you were to being like your master, the better off you were considered to be. Mm-hmm. And not only were you considered to be better off, but oftentimes people who did not look like you and who were not close to the master's looks, they would see that you got more privileges, you got more opportunity, and you were more likely to be elevated in the slave community because of your closeness to the master. Mm-hmm. And what happened is when that kind of thinking was placed into the consciousness of black people, and we were relieved from the plantation and ran off or walked off when slavery was abolished, we still had, and even till today, we still have that same mentality. Mm-hmm. And that's what has happened. So much so that the master does not have to be around today, but we can just participate in it, and we can also partake of, and we can make it a part of our program as if the master was still around, making us do it. And that's what we do today. It just goes so far back into slavery, yes, and so deeply into the roots on the plantation that it's almost difficult to get rid of. And we even see it today. I tuned in late. I was late. I always say I was late for class. But even when you look at the videos
that's right.
That are on YouTube, or the videos that are on BET or any of the other VHS1 or anywhere, it's always going to be the light-skinned sisters and the light-skinned brothers who are going to participate.
Right.
I was on a radio talk show last night, and so a brother was talking about how, and you've talked about it too, Bill, when we were in school, the campus queen, they're going to always be the light-skinned sisters.
Yeah. Always.
Right. And I told my brother, I have a brother in Newark, New Jersey, and I told him something, and he had a hard time believing me, and I think he got a little upset with me when I told him. But I was telling him about the comb test, about how when you used to attend the church in North Carolina, down in Winton or Hosky or Murfreesboro or some little small town, the usher at the door would have a comb in his pocket.
That's right.
And he would take that comb and run it through your hair. And if your hair would not go through that comb, if it stopped, you couldn't get in that church. And my brother is a kind of a, what they call a paper bag tan, for using that strictly for description. And his wife is a darker complexion sister, about your complexion, Bill. I said, if you come down south and you go to a church, you might get in the church, but your wife is not going to get in. She got to wait for you in the car.
That's right. Y'all just choose another church.
True. But they would also not only the comb, but they would have the paper bag. And if you were darker than that paper bag, you would not get in that church. They also had the pencil. They also had the door. And I won't go into all that.
Right.
But I've done some research in all this. But they had all these things to keep you, if you had the attributes or if you had the looks of being black, you were not going to get into the church in this particular environment. And if you were, in this party, if you were on a college campus. And even so, and even in Charleston, South Carolina today, they have what they call the Brown Society.
Right.
And the Brown Society is an organization that you have to be a certain complexion to get into the society, and not only goes into your life, but when you are deceased and you're dead, they don't even bury dark-skinned Negroes in the Brown Cemetery.
That's right.
We got it that bad.
That's right.
So it's terrible.
You know, Dr. Bridges, and to document what you said, you know, I'm old enough to have had relatives who lived during that time. And I had one of my relatives who told me he was a traveling teacher. He used to travel in different counties of North Carolina working in schools. And there were certain communities he could not go into unless he had gotten permission ahead of time to be able to enter that school to teach. And one time he had got an appointment to be the principal of a school up near Ahoskie. And they blocked him, and they finally let him in when the white superintendent stood up and said, I'm sending him up there to work. You got to let him in. However, he was told by the brothers of that community, all right, I got to deal with you, but don't mess with none of these women. I'm going to tell you right now, don't mess with these women. And that was, now he told me that himself. That didn't come out of a book. And I questioned him about it. He said that North Carolina was well known for that. And so you're right, Dr. Bridges. That is clearly that test, brown bag, cone, all that stuff. There were churches you could not go into if you were dark-skinned. You would not be able to get in that church. And we know some in Durham. Go ahead. Uh-huh.
And my brother, who I was relating this to, as you're talking to, he just told me, I don't believe that. I ain't never heard that. I say, well, man, just because you haven't heard it does not mean it does not exist. That's another thing. We as a people, some of this stuff is so incredible or so unbelievable, Bill, that you can tell some people this. They would not believe that we would be so crazy.
Right.
But we are made crazy. We're out of our minds, as I always say. We don't have our right minds. We've been robbed of our minds.
Yeah.
And now, and to take it out of this country, as you well know, this is one thing that the Caucasian European has done, as Sister Bernice was saying. This foolishness has been, and that's what it is, this color consciousness to make me think that I'm inferior to you because I'm a little darker than you. It is not just in the plantations and the black communities and the white communities of the United States of America, but it's all over the world.
That's right.
There's a reason that you go to the Philippines in the summertime and the Filipino people have umbrellas up so their skins won't get darkened by the sun.
Right.
There's a reason they buy umbrellas for that purpose.
Yeah.
There's a reason that Toussaint Louverture in Haiti had a problem getting rid of Europeans off the plantations of Santo Domingo. He had to not only deal with the white folk, but he had to deal with what they call the petit blancs, or blanc meaning white in French, and petite meaning small, the small whites. But he also had to deal with the so-called mulattoes, as somebody mentioned that term, I think, early on your program. But he had to deal with the mulattoes. And then that same foolishness left Haiti. When Haiti became independent, many of the slave masters went over to Louisiana, and some of the slaves followed their slave masters to Louisiana, and then they went down into Louisiana and established that damnable system called Creole society.
That's right. Do you know that right now in New Orleans, there is an octoroon?
It's crazy, man.
They have an octoroon ball. It's they still hold it. It's an octoroon ball where.
That's why I mentioned. I wanted you to bring it up. I was trying to key you into it. Go ahead. Go ahead. We're
talking. But that's it. You know, and they still do that to this day. Right now, that today is Fat Tuesday. A lot of that history of the Mardi Gras has to do with that light skin, dark skin stuff as it relates to black people. You know,
Do you know what? That's exactly what the Mardi Gras. Yeah, see, and since you mentioned too, Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday. That's French, and the Creole thing is French.
Right.
Octoroon, that's French, and octoroon and what's the other one? The mulatto octoroon.
Quadrooms and all that.
Yeah. I couldn't think about the quadroon. Right, quadroon is when you're supposed to be 1/4 black, from the word quad being the fourth, octoroon, eight-sided figures, an octagon. All that madness came from these white folks, Bill.
That's right. That's exactly
and
right.
And we do it now. Yeah. I mean, it still goes on right now. You know, I really get incensed by it because
but no,
it makes
you're right.
No.
You're right.
It's all over the world. I just mentioned the Philippines. We can take the same type thinking over into India.
Brazil.
With Gandhi. Gandhi never, ever outlawed the caste system in India. Look at the Mahinga people over in India, the dark-skinned people who are Muslims. They catching hell from the Hindus in India.
Yeah.
And the Hindus in India, the lighter Hindus at the top of the caste system and the darker ones going down to the bottom of the caste system.
Right.
The white man has done this all over the entire world.
He has. Let me go to this another.
Go to somebody else. I was tuned in late.
Stay right where you are.
I'm going to keep listening, though.
No, stay right where you are. Area code 646, New York City, 924. Are you listening, caller, or would you like to say something?
I'm listening, and I'd like to say something also, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead, please.
Well, you know, I was listening to you brothers talking and stuff, and I thought it was very interesting, but I want to get into the aspect of when we talk about TV and the impact of TV and how some of these notions of black and white are played out within society and educators. Look at somebody like Shonda Rhimes, for example, with Scandal.
Right.
Some of the stuff that you talked about or whatever in terms of the attraction toward white culture, and you know how I used to hear a lot of these sisters talking about, look how powerful this president is, and their desire to take on that culture and show that there's a black woman that could be dominated by a white man and still be powerful over her own life and things of that nature. And then you look at the confusion with Blackish and Mixix on ABC or whatever.
Okay.
And then just commented on what the other brother just said in terms of the Dominican Republic. I mean, you just look at the confusion that's going on now with the Dominican citizenship law, where these black people that came from Haiti and went to the Dominican Republic are now being told that you're not a citizen, you have to get out.
Yeah.
But they, you know, so I mean, this whole idea of colorism has not changed anything at all. It's always been a factor. And, you know, when you have somebody that is told, like Shonda Rhimes saying that she's like the one of the top people in the world to be an influencer, and then you show these images of white culture and society and how black people have to assimilate into that to be successful and to be just as ruthless as them, it's exactly the same thing you've been talking about.
That's exactly
And I'm going to shut up now.
No, that's good. That's great. That's very detrimental. In the same way. And I think history tells us that. You know, I think of if you go into some of the writings of Marcus Garvey, he ran into that mulatto problem in a large way. It started when he first got to New York, he said, when he went into the office of the NAACP and everybody in there was a mulatto. And so he said, what is this? He went in there to try to talk to W.B. Du Bois. But all the light-skinned folk were blocking him. He couldn't get any headway whatsoever. And then eventually, you know, Du Bois took on a negative role toward him. So a lot of that was light-skinned, dark-skinned stuff and doing that. And then Murray McLeod Bethune, some black newspapers were coming out that there's a gorilla in the White House. When she served on the Roosevelt cabinet, the black cabinet, they made notice that there's a gorilla in the house because she said she was ugly and looked like a gorilla. You know, stuff
and
like
you know,
that.
Am I still on?
Oh, Arturo Schomburg? Yeah, okay. Yeah, Schomburg Museum. Yeah, same way. He ran into that.
Right, and you know, You remember when Condoleezza Rice also went over to Russia to talk to Putin? Putin made a statement, and you remind me of it, Bill, when you talked about Mayor McLeod Bethune. Putin said, "Okay, so now they're sending the brass monkey over here." That's what Putin said about Condoleezza Rice.
All right. That's right.
And so we as people, we have just taken it from our slave master, and some of us actually go further with it than they do. We catch the sickness from our slave master, and then we pass it on to our children and our people, our relatives and our students in the classroom and people we work with. We take it further than the slave master ever took it. And then one more point, and I'm going to be quiet, and that is, when they started to give us this white image of Jesus and the man on the cross, and they put it into the religion, that's what really messed us up. When they gave us the white image of Jesus, and Jesus being the Son of God, and the Son of God being white, then you know what the daddy got to be. Yeah. So, you know, it's terrible. I'm glad you're talking about this tonight, but them Creole balls or something. Oh. That's where Prince is from too. You know, Prince Nelson Rogers. Prince is from New Orleans.
Same thing. Well, you know, look at what he did. You know, I like his music. He was a brilliant musician, but you know, he embraced that necrocracy, light skin.
And look what it did to his hair. And look at how he looked. That's why he was. I hate to say it, but that's part of the reason he was successful.
Right. Exactly.
And Beyonce is from there too. She's from New Orleans. You know, before she's from Louisiana. And the flip side of that is, look what Huey P. Newton did. Huey is from Louisiana too now, down in the French Quarters. Right. No, he's from Baton Rouge. Well, no, he's from New Orleans. But he went over to California. But Huey had that complexion, but he didn't play on that. He did it different. He picked up a gun and became a different kind of Negro. But he's from that same background down in Louisiana. That's where Huey P. Newton was from before he went over into Oakland, California, like a lot of people take that migration path that you've talked about, Bill, from the Southwest, and then they're going out to California and Arizona that way, you see. So Huey Newton is another example, but he used it a different way.
Exactly. I agree. Brother Marcus, how you doing?
Can I chime in for a second?
And a lot of people don't like to hear it, but all of Elijah Muhammad's national representatives, I'm going to be quiet for sure, except most of them have been light-skinned Negroes who they put out front. Yeah. And look at Rosa Parks. She wasn't the first person not to sit down on the bus. There was another woman who was a dark-skinned woman who did it before Rosa Parks, but they say, NAACP again, said she didn't look right. We can't use her as a role model.
That's what they say.
Quiet.
That's right. That's the fact. my brother from New York, 646.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in on something that the brother just said when he was talking about Prince. And if you ever watch anything dealing with any interviews with Alexander O'Neill, you know he's a dark-skinned brother, whatever. And he said that he had a problem with him being as dark as he was. That's one of the reasons why he got dropped from his group.
I didn't know
and
that.
Stuff.
Yeah.
So,
okay. How did you know he played with Prince? Alexander O'Neill played with Prince?
I might be saying the name wrong, but I'm trying to get it, but
I know Alexander O'Neill. I know he's a singer, and that's interesting, very interesting.
He was part of he did an interview, and it's on YouTube where you can see where he talked about his relationship with Prince, and that one of the reasons why he felt he got dropped was because he was too dark.
Okay,
so and then when you look at if you even just watch the movie Purple Rain, you look at everybody in the movie.
Really?
The majority of the people in there are highlight people.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Okay, Brother Marcus. Any comments, sir?
Dr. Rogers. You know, two phrases come to mind. You know, The Negro Seeks White Approval by Carla G. Woodson. And Garvey said, The Curse of Many Colors. You know, that's what we have. But, you know, we have to be kind of careful in this time, you know, because the blue-black Negroes doing foolishness too now. People like Mobutu, Jonas Savimbi, you know. Yeah, black people now, you know.
Right. Yeah,
so I think the litmus test has to be your character, what you do now, you know.
Right.
We have to look at your action because it's going to be, if we take the shade, it's going to be a division because we come in many shades.
Right.
You know, we come in many shades. Even when you go to the continent, you see it, you know. So the litmus test now is your action. What do you do? You know what I'm saying? Are you working in the interest of black people? Are you working against? You know, and that will give us a more a standard, because if we take this other position, it's going to be a problem in time.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
And that's all I got to say. Okay. Thank you, Roman.
Thank you so much, Brother Marcus. Area code 919-599. Area code 919-599. Are you listening? You want to say something?
They might be listening.
Okay.
Listen.
Hello?
Listening.
Yes. Would you like to add to this conversation, or are you just listening?
I'm just listening.
Okay. Very good. All
Bill.
Right. Thank you. Yes.
All right. I was about to say, now, the brother that just spoke, I understand his point, and I agree with his point. Now, I hear he had an accent. Now, is he from Jamaica, or do you know?
I think Jamaica. Brother Marcus, is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, Marcus from Jamaica.
Okay, good. Now, I want to just chime in for a minute here. Nothing to do with him, but the country that he's from, the Queen spread that foolishness all the way into the very inner fabrics of Jamaica now. When we talk about this culture thing, I mean, this color thing,
yeah,
it's all throughout Jamaica. We can look at it. And, Bill, you talked about it earlier, because Marcus Garvey was born in St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica, and Marcus Garvey had to deal with that color thing.
Yeah.
And I'm going to bring it back home a little bit. That even with all due respect, I love him. You know I do. Bob Marley. One reason Bob Marley made it because of his Scottish father. Bob Marley made it because of his light skin and that narrow, narrow aquiline, as Malcolm said, that narrow aquiline nose. And I'm a fine fan of Bob Marley, so I don't want people to say, well, he don't like Bob. No, but he made it because of that. You look at another member of his group. Look at Peter Tosh, who was dark complexioned,
yeah,
and who sang more black songs than Bob Marley, and was an excellent entertainer, some say even better than Bob Marley. But he didn't fit the profile of what what's his name? I can't even think of his name. The brother probably knows. The white man who pushed Bob Marley, who was Bob Marley's first manager, who gave Marley the money to get started.
Okay.
Blackwell, right. Chris Blackwell. Peter McIntosh. They call him Tosh for short. McIntosh, European name, Scottish name. That's another story. But Peter McIntosh, or Peter Tosh, was in Bob Marley's group. Tall, dark complexion.
Yep, sure was. Yep.
He didn't have the look that they wanted, so they pushed Bob Marley. So the brother talking about Jamaica, that whole British mentality, and that's why Meghan Markle, all up in there, it goes, oh, man, it's so deep.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all throughout the fabric of Jamaica now, that whole idea of color. And not only that, but even the fact that they don't want Jamaican people to speak in the so-called patois, they want you to speak in so-called pure British English.
Yeah.
You see, so like I said earlier, it's not how you look necessarily. It's the more you walk like them, the more you talk like them, the more you sound like them,
right,
the more you dress like them. Everything, the more you can be like the British, talking about Jamaica now, in Jamaica, the more you can be like the British, the better off you are. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I just use example of Marcus Garvey, Marcus Garvey, and also an example of Peter Tosh, and also an example of Bob Marley.
Okay. Brother Oshie, comments?
Hey, Doc, how are you today?
Man, doing great, my good brother. Doing great.
That's my brother, Ocean. Hotep, brother.
Hotep, Dr. Bridges. How you doing, sir?
All right, brother.
Good. Well, you know, I know your time is up, so I won't have too much time to comment on this. I've been listening, and I love it. You know, I think the problem for us is our lack of understanding of the dynamics of what we're working with, what we're working in. And the deep hole it has on our mind.
Right.
You know,
oh, man.
Make us think and behave, you know, in the way that we do. You know, we're at war for the minds of our people. That's why my program, I say all the time, you know, it's the African mind.
Right.
We're trying to change the African mind.
Exactly.
I end my program with Stephen Biko, the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed.
There you go. There you go.
Because they have our minds the way we act and behave the way we do, because they look, we want to be a reflective of them. And so therefore we have all these different sorority, fraternities, bag tests, and all this other stuff, all these other groups still today.
Right.
They've never gone anywhere. They have been groomed this way for literally now centuries. One of the things that the European must have is a buffer. Right. And the mulatto class, if you want to use that word, or the high yellows or whatever, they're that buffer because they believe
that
they are the closest to the European.
That's exactly right.
Our thing should be, I don't give a damn about the European. I'm trying to take care of what we need to take care of as African people here in this land and in the land that we need to go to. That's what should be happening.
Right. I agree.
But we still trying to see if we can, you know, make this Caucasian respect our humanity.
And that's what you've been doing on your program.
It's never going to happen.
Yeah, you've had some great guests.
It's never going to happen, Doc.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking the same stupid shit that we've been talking about for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. You know, and we keep thinking that something's going to click, that somehow some epiphany is going to happen. It's going to be like, no, it's not. And I don't give a damn who you got in the White House. You know,
that's a fact.
And I just got finished reading a piece. I may do it tomorrow because his brother didn't call me for this program, so I may do this tomorrow on Britain. You know, I hate the British. You know, but they said that history's going to be kind to Britain because they're going to write it. And damn it, it is. These were the worst sons of bitches on the planet. The British have killed more people.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
England, and taking more resources and more land than any other Caucasian.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
And they all have. Yep. The Danish, the Germans, the French, the Spanish, you name it, they all have.
Yep.
The Belgians, you know. Yeah. But the British were the most vicious. You know, I just got finished a little article on Tasmania and how they just wiped them out. A real case of genocide. But you see, the European Jew has got you to believe that when you hear the word genocide, you think of them.
That's right.
Right.
And they weren't genocided at all. Mm-hmm. Not in the definition or the description, but the brothers and sisters on Tasmania, they were wiped out. The Akwa Indians in what is now Dominican Republic in Haiti, they were wiped out.
Wiped out.
That's right.
Completely wiped out. Right.
Yes.
So
I'm saying, and they've been the only people on the planet that have done that.
Right. Yeah.
And yet, and still. We consistently try our damnedest
to be like them,
to appease them, to beg them, to go. I mean, and I agree that the religion, and that's one of the main crux of the problem.
Yeah.
Many of our people cannot let go of that religion. They can't let it go.
Right.
And I don't give a damn how dark you paint Jesus. Christian religion is European. Christian religion is Caucasian. Christian religion is white. Christian religion is at the root of the white supremacy. Now, you can say all that stuff that you want to. Number one, it's not historical. There ain't a damn bit of proof that it's historical. That's number one. The other thing is it has you believing in this particular deity, and it holds you because in your mind. I told this one brother, I said, you know, with your Christian religion, it's like this. I'd rather believe and it not be true then not to believe and it be true. See?
I've heard that.
You're scared.
Well, listen, scared I got it. We're over the time, Brother Ocean.
So I'll hold on to
this. We might have to continue on Ocean's program tomorrow.
Brother Ocean, we at the end of ours. So we already passed the 9 o'clock hour, but we are going to review this topic again. We're gonna come back at this again. I appreciate all of you who have been a part of our discussion. Thank you so much to our listening audience. We will be back next Tuesday, 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Central. Thank you so much, Dr. Bridges, and all the others who made comments. But we're gonna talk about this again, without a doubt.
And you know what, Bill?